Fantasy. Let's go. Yeah. Hey, hello, and welcome to Unbought and Unbossed, Canadian political news and views. This is show number 254. Today is February 29, 2012. Unbought and Unbossed is an independent voice dedicated to presenting and discussing the political and social issues most relevant to Canadian citizens. This radio show contends that the self-inflicted attacks of 9/11 are being used as the justification for the current overthrow of our democratic and sovereign nationhood, in effect, turning Canada into a corporate-driven plutocracy. The official story of the 9/11 terror attacks and the ensuing war of terror are deeply troubling and are at the forefront of this radio program. I strongly encourage listeners to question what you think you know about today's world events and to analyze the motives behind our traditional news sources. Each week, new segments of Unbought and Unbossed offer further evidence for these incredible claims, which are either ignored or distorted by the mainstream corporate media. Turn your televisions off. You are being lied to and conditioned to accept this madness as our inevitable future. We must work to return the future of the human race to its rightful owners. That's you. Okay, very nice. Thank you, Bruce Coburn, with the Action Speak Letter. This is Bruce as well with When It's Gone, It's Gone. How is everyone? Last week, we didn't have a show together. We had the Homelessness Marathon, and I caught bits and pieces of that. I really enjoyed that. I hope you did as well. So, what do I have? I've got a pretty busy show. I've got three interviews tonight, all telephone. First one out of Montreal with Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent researcher and writer. He is the project manager behind the People's Book Project. He also has a podcast, Empire, Power, and People. Another thing, he's working with Sybil Edmonds, the whistleblower, I believe FBI translator, with her Boiling Frogs blog. I hope I'm completely correct on that. And lastly, he is a correspondent with RT Television. The topic tonight, well, Andrew is working on this, the People's Book Project, and what he's been writing about most recently and studying and learning is the history of American imperialism in Latin America, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and Africa, mostly relating to the immediate decades after World War II as the principal focus. So what we're gonna learn about some of Andrew's research and how this history might connect to recent history. You know, maybe there's some lessons to learn, or, well, maybe not. Maybe we're just doing the whole damn thing over and over again, right? Oh, okay, so Andrew Gavin Marshall will be the first hour's interview. In the second hour, I'm going to be talking with Kevin Annett, a regular guest of the show, former minister turned whistleblower, and that kind of ended his ministerial career. And he's, well, now he's a churchless minister, I suppose. And this is an odd story concerning his smart meter. So we're going to be talking a little bit about smart meters, and he also says he has some good news. I don't know what that is, so stay tuned for that. Okay, and then lastly, in the last half hour of the show, we're going to have a telephone interview with political and social activist Rainbow John. Now, Rainbow is, I guess, kind of my correspondent on the Vancouver Occupy movement. So he's got a lot of information on what's going on with the, with the Occupy Vancouver and related topics. Okay, very nice. Real quickly, I've got some fantastic audio clips that I'm hoping to play for you. Not many of them. I don't think I'm going to get to all of them with three interviews, but this is some of the things that you may or may not hear. David Icke on the madness of war, and I guess that will tie in with Andrew Gavin Marshall talking about American imperialism. Also, Anonymous, that group, which I'm not a big fan of. However, they put out a video, or someone put out a video, a warning to the Black Bloc. And those are the goons that go around and bust shit up at demonstrations and protests. And I don't like that because that's what the cops do, you know, to paint all activists as goons. There are a lot of cops that are paid to be the goons, but then there's a lot of idiots out there that, well, I guess, want to be cops and bust shit up. So anyways, that's a a pretty good piece. Another one, this is a short one, the peace activist Cindy Sheehan. Well, the IRS has sued her for not paying her back taxes. This comes from ABC Radio. Now, her son died in the Iraq War, which is an illegal war, and she refuses to fund it. So she's not hasn't been paying her taxes for many years since her son died. Okay, another one, the Rick Mercer Report. His rant on online privacy, Bill C-30, in which you are either with internet warrantless spying on you, or you are with child pornographers. And that was a guffaw that Vic Taves foolishly said and has backpedaled on that. But Rick Mercer has a clever little short piece on that. Okay, another one. Iran, follow the money. And this is by Foster Gamble on the... he's the producer behind the recent Thrive documentary that was so popular a couple months back. And Foster Gamble is suggesting that that a false flag might be staged in order to attack Iran in this problem-reaction-solution world of... the way it seems that we start wars, interesting piece there. Another one on the robocall election fraud. What a mess that is. I think it's up to 40 ridings now, a couple in BC as well, in which, persons have called Liberal and NDP members and, basically given them incorrect information on where they're, voting, where they were to vote. You know, saying that it's changed to a different location when actually it hadn't. And so that might partly be responsible how the conservatives have a majority in the government. And so in this piece, Dan Dix from Press for Truth TV, he says, Stephen Harper, you are fired over this. And lastly, economic collapse, a mathematical certainty. So there's that piece. And then Buddy goes on and he says, the five places where not to be, when this economic collapse indeed happens. This is put out by New America Now. Now, this could be a worst-case scenario prophecy, or some people might say it's fear-mongering. I'll let you decide. So there we are. That's some audio clips that we may or may not get to. Again, in the first hour, Andrew Gavin Marshall, the young researcher and author. So let me see what else I've got to get the weather going, don't I? Let's get the weather on and take care of that. It's going to be wet. Okay, very nice. So that takes care of the weather. So as I get Andrew Gavin Marshall on the phone, I'm going to play a track by Payday Monsanto. And this is While You Were Grazing in the Field. And this is odd. It's it feels like it's only half the song. It kind of fades out, and it's like, that doesn't feel like it was completed, but that's okay, because I only need 2 minutes to get Andrew on, so that's what we're going to get. Okay, friends, this is the Unbought and Unbossed radio show on CHLY. We're at 101.7 FM on the radio dial, and you can listen near live streaming at www.chly.ca. Okay, friends, stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll be back with Andrew shortly. Here is Payday Monsanto, While You Were Grazing in the Field.
This is from the Scientific Outlook, 1931. Lord Bertrand Russell. Ordinary men and women will be expected to be docile, Jack, industrious, Jack, punctual, Jack, thoughtless, Jack, and contented. Jack. Do you know anyone who is like that?
Beware of the man trying to protect the pandas, posing as a philanthropist trying to end us. Propaganda straight from the Pentagon commanders. Since 1931, they've injected people with cancers. David Rockefeller sent Cornelius P. Rose to Puerto Rico to experiment upon the people. The good doctor murdered a dozen and then proceeded to revel in a letter. You should Google it and read it. That very year, there lived the great Lord Bertrand Russell. Nobody flexed more muscle for the New World Order hustle. 80 years ago, when a bookie basically told you how through diet and injection they were going to mold you. They make you dumb for the sum of tuition. Now it has all come plumb to fruition. Just one link in the chain of tyranny missing. A chip in your brain to enjoy your virtual prison. Warm and fuzzy speech will do to make you dream a dream or two. Plans like essential ability to think for yourself and reach your potential ability as they celebrate the West's infertility. And if you dissent, you will be sent to a mental facility. Scientific psychology perfected and pure as gradualism. They know you will accept it for sure. Not long ago, the sky was a deep blue azure, but most people don't even look up at it anymore. So when you tell slaves they've been getting sprayed like roaches, their eyes glaze like they're under some kind of hypnosis. Trying to follow along with the ticker tape, their brains put in an alpha state from the flickery. Nothing says nothing like stovetop stuffing. What you think they call a shit, the idiot box for nothing? High definition television's mandatory. Move closer, we want you to understand the story. Warm and fuzzy speech will do to make you dream a dream or two.
Okay, welcome back to Unbought and Unbossed Show. And as promised, I have Andrew Gavin Marshall on the other end of the phone. Andrew, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, welcome back to Unbought and Unbossed.
Thanks for having me.
Good, good. How are things treating you in Montreal land?
Well, it's snowy and cold, so.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So it's a Canadian winter, is it?
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Right, right. But you've been hitting the books a lot lately with your with your project, the People's Book Project, but you're also doing other things. You, since the last time we talked, which was I'm going to guess about 4 months ago, you've started doing a podcast in which you're calling Empire, Power, and People. Do you want to tell us a quick bit about that?
Yeah, sure. It's with Boiling Frogs Post, which is run by Sybil Edmonds, the former FBI translator turned whistleblower.
Yeah.
And I do a weekly podcast show, just on any topic, like the title says, Empire, Power, and People. It's quite broad, mm-hmm. which is perfect because that's my whole focus. So I've done several, about eight podcast shows so far.
Nice.
On tons of different topics, from the American Empire in Haiti and the Dominican Republic, Latin America, the Middle East, to the black history of the United States was the recent one that was put out,
mm-hmm.
History of public relations and other various ideas, and covering institutions and really focusing on the subject of power, and did a recent one on the Arab Spring
mm-hmm.
taking place. So it's tons of different topics, and it's great. I can just talk about whatever I want for as long as I want, and hopefully people enjoy it.
Right, right, nice. Let's mention some of your websites here. First off, we have andrewgavinmarshall.com,
yep.
And then also with your People's Book Project, thepeoplesbookproject.com.
Yep.
Any other website? Well, okay, you mentioned the Sybil Edmonds. What's the...
BoilingFrogsPost.com.
Okay, BoilingFrogsPost.com. Okay, good.
Yeah, it's a great source of information and news as well. She mm-hmm. puts out nightly news roundup, which is just full of excellent articles. It's one of the best alternative news sites that I'm aware of.
Very nice. Okay, well, I'm sure our listeners are happy to learn of that. Good. Well, as I told our listeners before I had you on, that you've recently been researching and writing about the history of American imperialism in much of the world. So
yep.
I think that's pretty much where you're going to want to share your information with tonight. So I'll just let you start where you feel
sure.
it would be a good place.
Sure. Well, the history of American imperialism is a long one. Mostly I'm focusing currently on the post-World War II period, but I cover four main sections. Each section is a separate chapter in my book at the moment, and I broke them up into four different areas. So there's Latin America, the Middle East and North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, and East and Southeast Asia.
Hmm.
And these have all been very explosive areas in the past 60 odd years,
mm-hmm.
and indeed much, much longer. And that's really been the period at which America has been the preeminent empire
mm-hmm.
or imperial power in the world.
Yeah.
But to talk about American imperialism, you also have to get into its history. America didn't just become an empire following World War II. It has a long history of it. In fact, it's perhaps the only state that I'm aware of could be wrong, that has been actually founded explicitly as an empire. George Washington proclaimed the United States to be a nascent empire, and one of the main reasons for the American Revolution against the British was to expand the colonial possessions in the Americas, because the British put up a line where the colonists could not advance further into the West, and that was one of their main complaints against the British, among several others, of course. But immediately upon establishing the new state, they began their westward empire building. And of course, then there was, during the 19th century, the American imperialism was mostly focused on eliminating Native Americans from the land. There was also several wars, and the chapter I'm currently writing is on the history of the American Empire in East and Southeast Asia. And interestingly, I discovered that the first American imperialism, like military intervention in Asia, was in Indonesia in 1832.
Wow. Huh.
When there was a private merchant ship docked at this small Indonesian town, Kuala Bitu, and the merchants were cheating and abusing the locals, who then seized the ship, prompting the Americans to have a marine invasion, and they destroyed the town virtually.
Hmm.
There was also, a few years later, quick, brief marine invasion of Vietnam, interestingly.
Hmm.
And then most of their interventions were in Korea for, there was 1880 and 1888. There was a brief exchange with Japan, which sort of set off the Japanese Empire and its start. And then in, of course, 1898, that was when America sort of became an overseas empire with its acquisition, the Spanish-American War, the acquisition of Cuba, and the war and occupation of the Philippines,
right,
which continued until the 1940s.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that that's where American imperialism began. That seems to be the most well-known.
Yeah, that's certainly, I mean, there's, I read one critic, I forget it, his name escapes me at the moment, but he pointed out that it's sort of a misnomer to equate imperialism with simply overseas possessions, because America was, of course, expanding and, you know, having war, taking Mexico, and doing all sorts of other adventurism on the continent itself. So if you define imperialism simply by going overseas and seizing territory and dominating lands, then sure, it began in 1898, but there's, I think, a good deal of merit into pointing out the flaw in that logic. But,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, 1898 certainly was a major turning point with McKinley as president and then Theodore Roosevelt, the unrepentant racist, who then expanded the American empire. And in the early 20th century, he implemented what was called the Roosevelt Corollary. And this refers to the Monroe Doctrine, which was established actually in 1823. And the Monroe Doctrine states that Latin America belongs to the United States. So that is its backyard, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was to keep out other foreign powers. At this time, it was the Europeans, namely the British, but also the Spanish and others, claiming that especially Central America, but Latin America in general, was America's rightful territory. But while that was written, that document was written in 1823, the Americans really didn't have a powerful naval presence or really any powerful presence in order to expel the Europeans from the area, so it wasn't really implemented until you saw the 1898 invasion of Cuba. And When this event is acknowledged in American history, mainstream history, which is rare that it's even acknowledged, it's usually presented as America kicking the Spanish out for the benefit of the Cubans.
Hmm.
But the reality, of course, was that there was a major Cuban national liberation movement which was trying to get rid of the Spanish. prior to the American intervention. And when the Americans intervened, they, of course, got rid of the Spanish, but the violence on all sides rapidly accelerated. And to the point where if the conflict simply continued between the Spanish and the Cubans, there was a study done on this, looking at the rates of deaths on both sides, and if it continued for a great deal of time, there wouldn't have been as many deaths as if the Americans hadn't intervened. And their intervention was not only designed to get rid of the Spanish, but it was designed to crush the liberation movement, which it successfully did. And that didn't come to bite them back until the Cuban Revolution of in the late 50s, when Castro came to power.
Mm-hmm. How is it that the states didn't take Cuba and you know, permanently make it one, you know, whether it be a state or a territory? How was that? It just seems that it would, you know, it seems so likely, you know, especially the, you know, the close proximity.
Yeah, that it wasn't an official protectorate, because there was a general view at this period in strategic circles that protectorates, official colonies, were undesirable and unnecessary. It was mostly the maintenance of a colony which was their main concern. Rather, it would just be more useful to build up domestic tyrants who you could support a little more peripherally, and not have to worry so much. You'd still have access to the resources as they did in Cuba. Citibank, National Citibank, which was a big Rockefeller bank, they owned Cuba, essentially. Everything went through National Citibank.
And it was
so close that really they didn't really see the need in establishing an official protectorate. The reason why that differed with the Philippines was because they were very interested in expanding into mainland China. And at the time, in the late 19th century, the Chinese Empire was essentially collapsed. The Europeans were intervening. The Germans, the Russians were taking territory in Manchuria and elsewhere. The Japanese had defeated the Chinese in the Sino-Japanese War of 1895. And the British were expanding their territory in Hong Kong and continuing to intervene in China. So the Americans were afraid, because they had a great deal of exports going to China at that time. They were afraid that they would lose what's called the open door policy. The open door policy was established right after the Sino-Japanese War in 1895 as a sort of free trade imperial policy, where the idea was that in any territories, there is an open door for foreign empires. They didn't use that word. They just said for trading partners, to be able to have equal terms of trade so that everybody gets the same deal. So it's not a formal colonial possession where the metropole, the imperial power, gets all the favored access of resources and trade, and the other empires get high tariffs and unfavorable trade restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
The open door simply refers to the idea that all empires benefit equally from the plundering of a nation. However, the American empire at this time, the American nation at this time, was the largest economy in the world, the fastest growing economy in the world, and had the greatest industrial production capabilities in the world. So the open door policy gives them an unusual advantage over all the other nations. So that's why it was very important to them. It wasn't out of any, you know, benevolent imperialism for their European brothers, but it was more just that it would guarantee their right to trade and have access to resources without necessarily having to take colonial possession.
Right. So we're talking about the end of the 19th century?
Yeah.
Right, and I'm guessing that the American Navy was quickly being built up?
Yeah, it was by no means what it is today. But,
yeah.
I mean, the British were still far more significant in that sense. But the move towards protecting their interests in China, and this was directly articulated by President McKinley and his Secretary of State, Day, and several other strategists in the United States at this time. And the idea was to acquire territories along the Pacific to, in the words of one chief advisor to McKinley, was to turn the Pacific Ocean into an American lake. And so in 1898, there was a debate in the U.S. Congress, and they decided to annex Hawaii with the specific goal of providing what they called a stepping stone to the east. And then in the same year, they acquired Guam. And then in the same year, they acquired the Philippines, and all for the same reason. That's why it was different, because Cuba was not put in the same sort of category as needing to be annexed, because the geographical proximity to Latin America was already advantageous for the Americans. It was just, you know, the idea there was, when the Monroe Doctrine was being formulated in 1823, a main strategist at the time said that in time, through the natural gravity, Cuba will fall into the American orbit, just referring to the geographical location. It's inevitable that Cuba will be dominated by the United States due to its proximity to the United States.
That's right.
You could not say the same thing for China. So naturally, they had to take a few protectorates in the Pacific Ocean to turn it into an American lake, as they said. And so that was really sort of the turning point, and Theodore Roosevelt you know, took over following McKinley's presidency. And Roosevelt, incidentally, he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906 for putting an end to the, or negotiating an end to the Russo-Japanese War of 1905. And it's fascinating to look at the history of presidents and prominent statesmen in the United States who have won the Nobel Peace Prize. Four come to mind. There's Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Jimmy Carter, Barack Obama, and let's throw in Henry Kissinger. All of these individuals have won the Nobel Peace Prize. All of them are ruthless imperialists, and all of them have left a particular scar upon Latin America itself. Teddy Roosevelt, of course, had the Roosevelt Corollary, which later justified the Cuban invasion and set the tone for American interventions in the Dominican Republic and elsewhere. And then you had Woodrow Wilson, who, of course, won the Nobel Peace Prize. Wilson was a political scientist. He was a professor at Yale. He's also hailed in the discipline of political science as being one of its main founders and progenitors. And there's something that political scientists study called Wilsonian idealism, which is all based upon his 14 points for the League of Nations, the right of self-determination, making the world, quote, safe for democracy, all these wonderful ideas and rhetoric. Well, if you, Wilsonian idealism in action is ruthless imperialism.
Right.
And not only that, but he was also ruthless on the domestic front in the United States. He had a Red Scare that far outweighed anything following in the McCarthy era, which is largely forgotten to history, but they arrested hundreds, if not thousands, of dissidents, immigrants, deported anarchists, socialists, Marxists, any other radicals. And that's where the FBI got its start, and J. Edgar Hoover specifically got his start doing surveillance and tracking and arresting black radicals in the United States. He always had a personal hatred for African Americans, and which later became abundantly clear with Martin Luther King. But that's where the Red Scare domestically was very repressive.
What years were those?
This was during Woodrow Wilson, so this was in the 1918, I believe, or 1917-1918 was the main Red Scare of Wilson, I believe, just because it was following the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, where they were promoting the rabid fear of you know, Marxism and communism and any radical ideology.
Right, so it tailed on that.
Let
me let our listeners know, Andrew, that we are in conversation with Andrew Gavin Marshall, a independent researcher and author currently out of Montreal. Okay, Andrew, carry on. I just wanted people that just tuned in to know what's what.
Sounds good. And Wilson His democratic idealism, I think, can best be examined through his imprint that he left in the Caribbean. And I'm specifically referring to Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In 1915, Wilson landed a marine occupation in Haiti, which the occupation itself lasted until 1934. Mm. So it was about a 19-year occupation. And then in 1916, he occupied the neighboring country on the same island as mm-hmm. Haiti, the Dominican Republic, which lasted until 1924. Mm. And these occupations were incredibly ruthless. I think the numbers go somewhere around 30,000 Haitians being killed mm. by the Marines, who were torturing and murdering indiscriminately. And interestingly, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the president who ended the occupation of Haiti, was Assistant Secretary of Navy at the time of the invasion. And so he was intimately involved in the invasion and occupation. And later, in the late 20s, he actually took credit for, as he put it, personally running several Caribbean republics. Hmm. And he said that he also personally rewrote the Haitian Constitution. And this is important because since the Haitian Revolution in the from 1791 until 1804, Haiti established that this is when the first successful black slave revolution in history, first successful slave revolution in history, no less so than black slave revolution, and they kicked the French out, they kicked all the empires out. And in their constitution since 1805, they had it written that no white man, no foreigner, hmm. can ever own land in Haiti. Hmm. And then that changed when FDR apparently rewrote the Haitian constitution in 1915 so that foreign interests could own land and interests in Haiti. And this right. directly benefited National City Bank, the Rockefeller Bank, which moved in and essentially took over the finances of both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. Right. American corporations went in and exploited the resources and set up industries.
I was going to ask about that. The Dominican Republic and Haiti, was it primarily for military posturing or was it for resource extraction or both?
Oh, well, there's a number of... I mean, to sort of limit everything to one reason, it's usually I find that there's always a, sort of a reason that stands out above the others, and I think in the case of the Dominican Republic and Haiti, the real reason goes to the fact that the other European powers, it was really an implementation of the Monroe Doctrine to keep out the other powers, mm-hmm. because what was taking place, the U.S., of course, had the Panama Canal, which they took, I believe, under Theodore Roosevelt, by ruthless force, of course. And so, of course, he wins the Nobel Peace Prize. But, I think to protect their route through the Panama Canal, the Germans especially were becoming increasingly influential in Haiti. And in the early 20th century, Haiti had just sort of a revolving door of presidents, one being killed, a coup right after the other. Mm. And all the European powers, and America as well, all had merchant houses in Haiti, were doing trade through and around and with Haiti, and were trying to expand their influence. And it's incredibly close to the United States. And the Americans didn't want the Europeans to gain an advantage. They were very nervous about encroaching European dominance on an island so close to the Panama Canal, which controls so much American trade. And at this time, we also have to keep in mind that America's chief industrial rival in the world was Germany. It was no longer the British. They were in an obvious decline at this point, but the Germans were rapidly accelerating their industrial development. And so the fact that the Germans were increasingly involved in Haiti, more so than perhaps any other European power at this time, made the Americans very nervous. So they decided to move in, kick out all the other European powers, which the occupation successfully did, and it established American hegemony over both Haiti and the Dominican Republic. They took over all the sugar industries and interests and expanded their control and monopolies and got rid of all the competition. They built up the domestic police and military forces, which then ruled the countries for decades and arguably nearly a century. And so, of course, Woodrow Wilson received a Nobel Peace Prize. And the repeated interventions in both these countries has been continuous throughout the 20th century. Roosevelt, when he was president, implemented what he called the Good Neighbor Policy for Latin America. And this translates into, the idea, the rhetoric behind it was that America will be a good neighbor with its allies in Latin America and promote trade and support them. But it translates into being a good neighbor to dictators who ruthlessly oppress their own domestic population.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Dominican Republic, as a direct result of the occupation, the American occupation, you saw the rise of Rafael Trujillo as the ruthless dictator in the Dominican Republic. And he was so ruthless, and he built his regime not only upon a military dictatorship, but also upon racial ideas of the era. And this goes back to the occupations themselves. If you look at sort of the comments from, say, the Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, who was William Jennings Bryan. He's hailed as a democratic idealist, of course. But prior to the occupation of Haiti, he knew nothing about Haiti. He actually referred to that, he called Haitians, or he was talking with an advisor, and he said, imagine that, niggers speaking French. That was his vision of Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And so Haiti, where it was predominantly black, you know, it was treated worse because they were black. The Dominican Republic was what they referred to as spics, so you could treat them a little better, but you still had to be brutal. And this was reflected in the post-occupation regimes. And in Trujillo, he was, of course, of Spanish descent, as all the dictators were in the region. And so he built his Dominican military dictatorship upon racial lines, declaring the depravity and sort of submissiveness of the black Haitians and wanted to get rid of them, except for the ones who were in the sugar plantations as cheap labor.
Mm-hmm.
They were useful. But the ones who were just sort of sitting around taking up space in the Dominican, they threatened the purity of the Dominican race.
Mm.
And so he implemented a genocide where he wiped out about 30,000 Haitians, while the United States was treating him as a good neighbor.
Right.
And the United States actually undertook a propaganda campaign in his defense while FDR was president. And at the time, this became a bit embarrassing because the press, even some of the American press, were starting to point out the parallels between Trujillo in the Dominican and other dictators in the 1930s who were establishing ruthless military dictatorships and talking about racial ideas. And they said that the only two other dictators in the world who compare to Trujillo are Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini.
Hmm. Wow.
And the parallel of, you know, these two are our enemies and this one is a good neighbor raised some interesting contradictions. But nonetheless, they supported him until it was no longer able to, and there was a revolution in the late 50s, early 60s, at which time John F. Kennedy was president. And it's interesting, doing a lot of research on the history of American imperialism, one of the best resources I have found is actually the State Department website.
Mm, nice.
And this is because they have published on their website literally thousands of declassified diplomatic, State Department cables, CIA documents, Pentagon documents, National Security Council documents, White House documents, from, well, the dating back to the 1800s, but through the presidencies of Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, all the way to Ford.
Wow.
They have literally thousands and thousands of documents. It's
okay.
WikiLeaks, but more historical.
Right.
And arguably more of them. And so going through a lot of these sources, you find some. First, you end up sifting for hours and hours and hours and
mm-hmm.
days and days through
yep.
a lot of nonsense, but you find some gold in there. And one piece I found regarding the Dominican, revolution in the early 60s, what happened was that in 1961, you have Juan Bosch, who was a populist leader, and the Dominican Republic was transforming into a democratic country. But the main fear, and this is reflected in all the internal documents of the era, the main fear of American imperialists of the era was in other regimes, other countries establishing, becoming a Cuba, another Cuba. After Cuba, they were just so paranoid. And one of the National Security Council documents, and the National Security Council is the highest planning body in the American government. It's where all the different agencies, CIA, Pentagon, State Department, get together and plan imperial strategy. So their documents are the most important. There was a National Security Council document from, I believe, 58, 59, which said that the real problem with Cuba was not that it was communist. The real problem with Cuba was its successful defiance of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this goes to the idea of the tyranny, the terror, of a good example. And this runs through any imperial history, but, you know, often when you just talk about, say, American imperialism in Haiti and how, you know, the United States, Canada as well, and France orchestrated a coup in 2004 because the Democratic president tried to raise the minimum wage, people say, you know, well, that's ridiculous. What's the American interest in Haiti? It's such a tiny, little, insignificant country. There couldn't possibly be any imperial interest. It doesn't have massive oil reserves, and it's all the usual sort mm-hmm. of line that you get back. But there's a notion that often just is overlooked, which is the idea that the smaller the country, the bigger the threat. And that's because if a small little country, especially a small little country so close to the home of the empire,
can be defiant,
is able
yeah.
to successfully defy it,
right.
and any country can.
Hmm.
So the small ones not only have to be taken under control, but they have to be ruthlessly punished, because
right.
that sends a message.
Yeah, to make an example, yeah.
Exactly. You don't publish the ruthless oppression, you know, in your media, because you tell the domestic population that we're spreading democracy and freedom and, you know, McDonald's, except what you actually do is the ruthless oppression itself spreads from the people across the region, because the region takes notice. The oppressed people, they notice when they're being oppressed, and word of mouth spreads fast, and you know, we're not exposed to media from these regions of the world, especially back when all this was taking place, and so it serves as an example. So they have to be ruthlessly oppressed,
mm-hmm.
and there was this rabid fear of Cuba all taking place in the 60s and for much longer than that. And in a National Security Council meeting in, I believe it was 1961, they were discussing, the Kennedy administration was discussing the prospects for democracy in the Dominican Republic.
Mm-hmm.
And at this meeting, President Kennedy said, well, I would very much like, prefer to have a democracy come to power, which of course means a democracy that favors the
yeah,
United States.
That's right.
And then he said, barring, you know, but the worst thing I could imagine is to have a Castro-style dictatorship. So while I prefer a democracy, if we can't get that, I prefer what he called a friendly dictatorship. Now, if you look at these two words put together, they don't make any sense.
Right, yeah, an oxymoron, yeah.
Yeah, like, who is a dictatorship friendly to? Its own population? Obviously not. So it's something that can only make sense spoken from an imperial perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because the dictator is not going to be friendly to those he's dictating, but he is friendly to the imperial power. And so it's common sense for imperialists, but it's totally illogical and paradoxical and absurd for general common sense. But we can't look for common sense in the National Security Council. And on that same note, the presidents at another National Security Council meeting when the revolution first took place, this was a few years later, Kennedy had been assassinated, Johnson was president, And there was a prospect that there was about to be a democratic populist president in power, which is such a terrifying thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another good example, of course. And so they were threatening to invade. They wanted to literally invade the country, and were trying to figure out how to do this, how to justify it. And a suggestion came from Robert Kennedy, who was the attorney general at the time. And he said, and in the document, the person who wrote the document, I forget, some top official, quoted Kennedy and said that apparently, Robert Kennedy said apparently seriously, that the United States should consider blowing up its consulate in the Dominican Republic in order to justify an invasion.
Mm, there you go. Yeah.
And, I mean, this is just incredible that it reflects sort of these ideas. And this fear of populism is another thing that's very, very popular in the internal documents of the American Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes for every single region of the world.
Right, right. Yeah, interesting that you mentioned a false flag, because in this latest war of terror that the states are involved in, much greatly based on the 9/11 false mm-hmm. flag attack, being which we're nearing the end of this, and I'm hoping that Andrew Gavin Marshall that we can kind of steer this to the most recent example of the American Empire, if we can still call
sure.
it that, and kind of I guess kind of slowly wrap it up. But if we could maybe move into the present day,
yep.
and how does the American Empire still exist, or is it more of a corporatist empire? What are your thoughts on recent American history and their invasions and occupations?
Well, I don't think there's been too much change. It's always been very corporatist, at least since the 20th century on,
mm-hmm.
And that simply just refers to the fact that it, you know, supports the corporate adventurism around the world, which was distinctly American, though it has historical precedents, you know, British East India Company, Dutch East India Company, mm-hmm. what have you. But in the modern context, it's exacerbated and globalized to a significant degree. What we're seeing today is the attempted inclusion, and this, you know, of course, goes from World War II on, but trying to more include the Europeans in their misadventures and ruthless oppressions. The French are just jumping on board with everything they can. But, no, I think, you know, you look at the Arab Spring, I think, is a great example. American imperialism today is more seasoned, I guess you could call it,
mm-hmm.
than it was in its origins, which were a little more blunt. It's getting more obvious in the sense that it's just, you know, every month it seems that there's another mm-hmm. great threat to America.
Yeah.
You know, if we don't intervene here, eventually Libyans will invade L.A.,
mm-hmm.
you know, or just some more absurdities, and it's getting more absurd.
Mm-hmm. It seems now that the states make an attempt to go to the UN to get the world's backing, and
mm-hmm.
Often when that fails, they say, "Well, that's okay. We're still in control of NATO, and we're going to do it on, you know, with NATO leading the charge."
Yeah, but that's been the whole purpose of the United States nation since its founding. If you go back to the Roosevelt presidency, which of course founded the United Nations. The planning documents all through the early 40s, they were done in cooperation with the State Department and the Council on Foreign Relations. It was a very secret project financed by the Rockefeller Foundation called the War and Peace Studies Program, where they were planning the post-war world. And one of the strategists, he was a geographer, his name escapes me at the moment, he said that we need to, you know, make the American Empire not appear to be like the formal European colonial empires, which were all discredited during the war. And so we should build an international body through which we can make it seem like it's a more benevolent, global, cooperative maneuver. And all through the history, you know, they take things to the United Nations and try and get resolutions passed and what have you. And if it doesn't work, then they say, okay, well, we'll just do it on our own because we can.
Right,
and
yeah.
because we own the world. And we're simply keeping the world. And that's one thing that I think is very important to recognize in terms of imperial ideology, and this goes from the early 1900s right to today. And it's the idea that we own the world, and it's simply ours. It's like, you know, all the resources in these countries, they belong to us. It's just an accident that they don't exist inside the United States itself.
Right.
But they really belong to us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's no questioning of that. That's just assumed. Mm. That's taken at face value. And it's always been reflected that way. And we can assume that it always will be. But it's, you know, it's, if you look at the United Nations history, there was one incident during the Suez Crisis in 54 where the French and the British were just wanting to invade Egypt as much as they could, as, mm-hmm. as soon as they could. They just wanted to ruin Abdel Nasser, who embarrassed them by nationalizing the Suez Canal. And so they took a resolution to the United Nations, and the U.S. Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, this is in the Eisenhower administration, he asked the British and the French quietly through diplomatic channels, I'm wondering if you going to the United Nations is to find peace or make war. And their response was that we don't think peace is possible. And, of course, they invaded. And so it's interesting to note how they go through the motions. We go to the UN, we talk about trying to find peace, but the whole time they say that peace is impossible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you start with that assumption, then the end result is a foregone conclusion.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and this goes right to the United States today. Mm. We pass a resolution on Libya, establish a no-fly zone, and then we invade.
Mm.
And then we bomb the country to smithereens.
Yeah, yeah.
And we try and pass a resolution on Syria, and then, oh, that doesn't work. We'll find another way.
Yeah. Andrew Gavin Marshall, we are just about out of time. I'd like to thank you for spending the last 40 minutes with us. Your websites are andrewgavinmarshall.com and thepeoplesbookproject.com. I will have those on my website that listeners can visit and link to. So I guess I'm going to give you a final minute to summarize. And again, thanks for the late night staying up in Montreal for our West Coast show tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. It's always great to come on. And for a final word, I guess it's in terms of just understanding imperialism, understanding the ideology, it's very important to sort of look at this history to understand where we are, but also to understand how we can change it. Because if we expose the ideology itself, the ideas of empire, if we deconstruct those ideas, we can come up with new ones.
Mm.
And I think that's the most important thing, is that we really have to start being creative in our solutions, in not simply, you know, choosing between A or B, black or white. We can really create new solutions. Mm. And I think that's where the path that we really have to go on, and that's the only way that imperialism can truly be defeated, because it is our responsibility.
Mm.
Being in pseudo-democratic countries,
yeah,
where the empire comes from, it's our responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well said. Good point. And, you know, you're kind of walking the talk there with you know, getting these fairly recent state documents, and you know, trying to make sense out of American imperialism, which is an absolutely huge topic. But you know, well done for tackling this this mountain
well,
here.
Well, thank you, and right back at you.
All right, partner. Well, be well, and I'd love to have you back again later in the year.
Sounds great.
Okay, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Good
cheers.
Day. All righty. Okay, very nice. That was Andrew Gavin Marshall again out of Montreal tonight. The website is andrewgavinmarshall.com. Okay, I've got Kevin Annett coming up in a short while. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play a couple audio clips that I need to take care of, then a song, and we will be back with Kevin Annett. Partly we're going to be talking about a bizarre story concerning the smart meter on his residence. And like I say, he also says he has some good news, so that is good. Okay, friends, this is the Unbought and Unbossed show. We are on CHLY, which is 101.7 FM on the radio dial. And you can also visit us online at www.chly.ca. We have podcasts. You can listen live streaming. We have news. We have videos. Lots of good stuff there. Okay, friends, there we are. Stay tuned. I'm going to play a couple clips. A Dylan song, High Water, is the track, And then I'll be back with Kevin Annett. Okay, friends, be well out there. Okay, very nice. That was Bob Dylan with High Water. Okay, as I promised, I have Kevin Annett on the other end of the phone. Kevin, are you there?
I am. Hi, Ray.
Hi. Welcome to the show. You're back east tonight, doing yep. one of your many travel trips. Well, welcome to the show. And so, as I told my listeners, you had a bizarre smart meter situation happen, but you also have some other news that you'd like to give an update on. So I'll just let you take it where you want.
Well, yeah, I'm actually calling from New York City. I've been here a little while, meeting with people, having a really amazing reception.
Nice.
I've had a number of television interviews, and people are just, as usual, shocked to hear about what goes on in Canada, towards Aboriginal people and others.
Yeah.
They had no idea about these residential school murders and crimes. So it's really created quite a stir. And I was today down at Occupy Wall Street at Ducat Park. Which is where the cops came in and cleaned out all the tents and made everybody move.
That's right.
It's really interesting, though, the amount of corruption in the New York Police Department that's surfacing.
Mm.
The things you learn on the street from people here are amazing, but it's really quite an amazing city, just the energy and the way people are engaged at every level here. It's quite something.
Good to hear,
It's been really good. And in the course of this, one thing that happened, I just heard... people probably remember I was working, and I'm working, with the Mohawks in Brantford.
Yes.
At the oldest residential school. And we've started a process of examining the grounds for the graves of the children who died there, and even doing initial testing. Well, last November, we posted a few things on YouTube. And soon after that, I got contacted by a group of Cree elders in northern Ontario. And they said they were going to look into the possibility of starting a dig of their own.
Wow.
Their school, not relying on the government of the churches at all, but going on their own, declaring, like the Mohawks have done, declaring sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
and starting that process. Well, recently we heard from them, and they've started the process. They're bringing in ground penetrating radar, like we did in Brantford, and they're going to start digging at the site of where they think the children are buried, and they're going to bring the children home for a proper burial. So this is a really exciting development, because it means the example the Mohawks in Brantford is spreading, it's going to put enormous pressure on the government to finally do what they've been promising, which is to disclose what they found out and some of the records regarding these missing children. And ultimately, this is the kind of thing we need to bring the full disclosure out. So it's just a really promising development that other Native nations are taking up this call to not rely on this kind of bogus Truth and Reconciliation Commission, but do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just a really development I wanted to share with people.
Very nice, very nice. Well, I'm happy that you're being well received, like you were saying, with the interviews. Now, are you going to be visiting elsewhere? Are you going to visit the Cree Nation or the Mohawk on your return trip?
I am. Right after this, I'm taking a bus up to Brantford, and I'll be meeting with the Mohawk elders, planning, the next phase of what we want to do. We've had some unfortunate attempts in Brantford to undermine what we're doing. There was an effort by some of the government-funded Native people in the Brantford area to intervene and try to disrupt relations between the 9 elders who invited me, to try to split them off from not supporting me anymore.
Okay.
And to, rounce any of the work they've been doing. So unfortunately, that's caused a lot of dissension. There was even an effort to circulate a story that these bones had disappeared, that I was kind of absconding with children's bones, the kind of smears that you could expect. But all of that is coming from the same source, and these are, natives associated with the local government-funded band council. It's
okay.
called the Confederacy
yeah.
Chiefs. What's interesting about that is that we found a document, or we didn't find the document, but we spoke to the person who has access to this document, where it shows that as far back as 1870, the Confederacy chiefs, who are, again, the ones set up by the Crown, not the traditional elders, they had an agreement with the Crown of England to operate this Mohawk residential school as long as it was the Mohawk children who were being targeted. And what's amazing about that is that it's kind of the smoking gun document showing that they were attempting to wipe out the Mohawks using this the residential school there. So it's an amazing document. Unfortunately, the woman who accessed it was put under a 10-year gag order by the Anglican Church, which ran the school. And we're still trying to locate this. But, I mean, it shows you the extent to which they were going to target a particular group like the Mohawks for eradication, using the residential school. So that in combination with the ongoing attempts to bring back the remains of the children can be very explosive. And I think it's one of the reasons that we're being targeted, you know, for this the same kind of internal sabotage that I've experienced a number of times over the years. But I don't think in this case it's going to work because the truth now is out there so widely, you know, all over the world, all over the Internet now about what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, another project that you're involved in, just showing the international scope of this, is Occupy the Vatican. Do you want to give us, is there any news on that?
Well, yeah, the Occupy the Vatican movement is actually spreading. There were some people in New York here who were actually talking about it today. It's a whole effort to link up with groups all over the world to converge on Rome. And there's the Italians are planning to actually build a human chain around around the Vatican. Wow. About 2,500 or more people are going to do that during April and May at various times. And they're going to, they've been talking about holding occupations in surrounding St. Patrick's Cathedral on May 1st, which is the day that Occupy Wall Street has asked everyone around the world to stop, you know, using your credit card, stop going to work, boycott the whole system on May the 1st and try to extend that. That's, you know, a project they're working on, and they're now including, they've got the Vatican and these churches in the crosshairs now as well. Mm-hmm, so, I mean, it shows you that, you know, as I said to somebody today, the Vatican is the oldest corporation on the planet.
Right.
And the most insidious. And so definitely we have to include that when we're talking about taking back our land and our planet and our very lives from this corporate oligarchy that's running it now. So we, you know, again, these are all really encouraging developments. And just to be on the ground with people here is really exciting because there's a lot of determination here. People aren't giving up at all.
Nice. You mentioned that you went to Zuccotti Park. What is going on there right now? Are there still occupiers protesting? What's going on the street?
Constantly. Every night I'm there this week, it shifts around a lot because, you know, there's 22,000 cops in New York City. They all converge to try to shut this stuff down.
Okay.
And although the cops themselves are pretty lethargic about it, I talked to a bunch of them, and they don't particularly oppose the protest or anything. They're pretty upset about their own situation, you know, as overworked city employees, and whose own pension is being gutted by the city, you know.
That's often. Right.
So, I mean, it's they recognize, you know, some of the stuff as well, but the protesters, nevertheless, have been forced to move around, kind of keep on the move. But they're, you know, all over the lower Manhattan, they're just occupying all sorts of different locations. And there's a hell of a lot of energy, you know, which you can expect in the Occupy group. So.
Yeah, nice. I've got Rainbow John. I believe you're familiar. He used to call your show on CFRO and Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Right.
He's going to give us an update on the Vancouver Occupy movement, and there's a lot going on there as well. So this movement is not
okay,
going
well,
away.
Maybe I'll just sign up then, Ray. But I want to remind everybody to follow our work at hiddennolonger.com. You can see our film and our book there. And we're going to be planning a lot of events in April and May to coincide with the Occupy the Vatican stuff. So stay tuned to hiddennolonger.com and itccs.org.
Right, right. Before you go, I had another question concerning last year when you went to England. Heck, it might have even been the year before. You had a problem. They didn't want to let you in. I'm just wondering, how is it crossing the American-Canadian border? Are you put in a special line, or is it smooth sailing?
No. There's been no problem at all coming into the States. And, you know, I think in the case of being barred from England, it definitely had to do with the fact that I was to speak at that anti-child trafficking rally in Trafalgar Square.
Okay.
You know, and that, you know, we'd be naming the Crown of England as complicit in this genocide and that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm not worried about that. In fact, it's funny how much light is shining itself on this today, and the kinds of things that we often fear aren't really there when you push it a little bit. So I'm hopeful very much that these things are not going to stand in our way.
Mm-hmm. Good to hear. Okay, Kevin. Well, thank you very much for the update, and well done to the Cree Nation in Northern Ontario. They too are not satisfied with the official with the officialdom, and that they're sounds like they're willing to stand up and demand justice and make it happen.
That's right, and we're going to look to the Squamish Nation on the West Coast to start the same thing. They've already ordered the eviction order on the Catholic, Anglican, and United churches, and we've got indication from Chief Capilano that he's encouraged by what's happening back east here. So we hope to see action right on the West Coast as well.
Nice. Okay. Well, again, thank you for the late night visit in New York City. So I wish you the best and safe travels on the rest of your travels.
Thanks, Brother Ray, and we'll talk to you all soon.
That sounds great. Thanks, Kevin.
Okay.
Good night. Okay, very nice, Kevin Annett in New York City. So I did Montreal and New York, and next, Rainbow is out of Vancouver. So got some long distance going. Thank God I'm not paying it. You guys are. Campus Community Radio. We got a fun drive coming up, guys, and you know what that means. You got to pay my phone bill. Okie dokie. This is the Unbought and Unbossed Show. I am its host, Raymond Geisler. The radio station is CHLY. We're 101.7 FM on the radio dial, and we're international on the internet with www.chly.ca. I have a website. I got a phone call right quick. That's interesting. What the heck? I will take it. Oh, no, I won't. No, they hung up. Okay, so much for that. Okay, that threw me off a little bit. Where am I going with this? I have Rainbow coming up in a short while. Campus Community Updates coming up in a short while. Oh, I was going to get my website. And then that damn call again. All right, private caller. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, welcome to Unbought and Unbossed.
Yeah, we didn't hear about Kevin Annett's smart meter.
I know. I don't know why he didn't go into it.
And the happy news that resulted in him having his, you know what.
Well, I think the good news was the Cree Nation are going to do similar to what the Mohawk did.
Well, what happened to his smart meter? No, not his smart meter. What happened to his hydro?
Well, I don't know why he didn't talk about it. I know a little bit about the story. I was at his place last week, and I pulled up. I'm thinking, man, it's awfully dark in here. And I'm with my lady friend. She goes, no, I see a candle. Oh, okay, well, all right. Well, we go in, and no lights are on because there's no power.
Oh.
And apparently, I don't know if I'm 100% correct on this, being that he didn't speak on it and give a follow-up on it. But what I understood was that BC Hydro came to put the smart meter on. They said, we don't have access or adequate access to your meter, and therefore they climbed the power pole and turned their power off.
Yikes.
And I had never heard that, because the refuseniks so far, the hydro people are basically just saying, okay, well, that's fine, but, basically we will be back and you will be getting the smart meter, but we're going to pretend that you won this first battle.
That's right.
And that was the only case that I had heard of that they climbed the pole and shut their power off. So, Kevin's obviously a marked fellow. Whether that was it, I don't know. And he didn't go into it, so I it's all speculation now. So
okay. Well, we want to know more later.
Well,
okay,
I tried.
Rainbow John.
All right, thanks for the call.
Okay, bye.
Cheers. Okay, thanks. Thanks for that. I was about to do something. I was going to give my website. That's what it was. If you want to listen to previous shows or find out the specifics of who and what was on and was played, links to all this stuff as well, you can visit unbossed.livejournal.com. unbossed.livejournal.com. Okay, I think I'm going to play a short audio clip. Oh, I told you about this one. It's the anonymous warning to the Black Bloc. And let's see, 2 years ago exactly, I had a couple interviews with the Vancouver Olympic protesters. And one of the interviews was a self-admitted Black Bloc participant defending why it was cool to go and bust shit up. And it's not. It wasn't then, it's not now, and it won't be in 2 years from now. So Anonymous is basically saying, you goons are, you know, doing what the police want you to do. You're doing their role for them, you know? And, yeah, so we're going to listen to this piece, then we're going to come back with the campus community update, and then we'll get on to Rainbow and find out what's going on in the Vancouver Occupy movement and others. He's also a marijuana activist as well. So we got 420 coming up, so I guess there's a big do going on for that, of course. So, yeah, there we are. So let's do anonymous warning to Black Bloc. Oh, why is it not starting where it's supposed to? Oh, shit. Well, all right. Well, we'll see what happens here. Okay, friends. There we are. That's the Unbossed and Unbossed Show. And it's live. Could you tell? Huh? Can you? Can you tell? It's live. Live radio? All right, friends. Be well out there.
We are anonymous. The response from fellow Anons to Black Bloc has been overwhelming. Peacefully shutting down banks and locations has had a far greater economic impact than Black Bloc's pitiful acts of vandalism could ever dream of. If you truly want to protest in such a manner, you should take it to the homes and websites of those you protest against. Replacing a window is nothing to them, you are not even a nuisance. This issue has been discussed many times during the past several months, and there appears to be a popular consensus that your tactics of chilling and intimidating the citizen press, breaking the windows of small businesses, terrorizing innocent employees and bystanders, and sometimes outright assaulting Occupy protesters are unacceptable. You are at best misguided, harmful, and idiotic in your actions. But more than anything, it is your cowardice in hiding behind the banner of the Occupy movement, using Occupy protesters as shields, and attempting to pin your actions on Anonymous that will not be forgiven. We suspect that many of you are agent provocateurs. As for the rest, who behave in such a manner, your tactics demonize us in the eyes of the general public, robbing Occupy of much needed support, both in finances and approval. And worse, your activities provide the illusion of justified police brutality, robbing Occupy of the moral high ground, and providing ammunition to the media. Consider this an act of diplomacy, before we start doxing your asses all over the internet, and paying special attention to personally ruining your lives. You have a choice: abandon your pathetic, ineffective, and counterproductive tactics, and join us, or step aside, or risk the wrath of Legion. As of now, we are asking all citizen journalists to expose any Black Bloc using Occupy or Anonymous as a shield. If they attempt to chill your freedom as press, get up in their faces, call protesters around you for support. But do not respect the anonymity of any Black Bloc who hide behind Occupy and Anonymous. They are not anonymous, they are cancer, and must be devoured for the good of the Legion. To any Black Bloc to whom this does not apply, we advise you to stay well away from citizen journalists and choose your targets wisely. If you harm Occupy or attempt to pin your thuggish crimes on Anonymous, we will not forgive. If you travel like a gang and attempt to intimidate Occupy, we will get all up in your base, finding all your secrets and wiping out your toots. We are everywhere. We are hidden in plain sight. We will follow in the shadows. We will circle you like wolves. And if you slip, we will devour you without mercy. You will not know friend from foe, and once injected into the hate machine, we will periodically reintroduce you to it. You will not know peace again for a very long time. We deliver, you do not. We are Anonymous. We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us. Read Rule 6.
Hey, kids, that was kind of scary, eh, the end of that? Yeah, scare me straight. And, yeah, about that. About the Black Bloc or the Canadian police forces acting as Black Bloc. If you want a little proof, you can watch the video produced by Press for Truth from Dan Dix. It's called Into the Fire, and there's quite a few examples of very suspicious police activity going on. So, don't act like a cop. Don't be busting shit up at protests. He put together a summer camp for him. That was going back maybe 25 years ago or so, but that was something he was involved in as well. So so very nice. A Wave of Gravy documentary. Well, I guess it's a documentary. There we are. Okay. There is some campus community updates for you. Now, I'm going to play two real short audio clips before I get Rainbow John on the phone. First one is it's from ABC News, and it's concerning peace activist Cindy Sheehan. Well, I guess the IRS is suing her for not paying her taxes. And Cindy Sheehan's son was killed in the Iraq War, and she says it's an illegal war, and therefore you're not using my money to go and kill other people. And following that, another short one, a Rick Mercer report rant on the online privacy Bill C-30. Again, Vic Taves stuck his foot in his mouth and said, you're either with us or you're with the child pornographers. Yeah. Okay, friends, so that's what you're going to get for the next 5 minutes, and then Rainbow John will be on after that. Reminder, this is CHLY. It's the Unbought and Unbossed show, and it's live radio. Okay, Cindy Sheehan, take it away.
More money woes, this time for anti-war activist and former Occupy Sacramento protester Cindy Sheehan. The IRS sued Sheehan to get her financial records. A spokesman told News 10 the information may be relevant to the collection of Sheehan's unpaid federal income taxes for 2005 and 2006. Cindy Sheehan speaks to News 10 after learning that the government's going after her for tax evasion.
News 10's Cornell Bernard spoke to Sheehan tonight. He's here now with more on her emotional response. Cornell?
She is the Army mom turned activist, most famous for demanding to speak with President Bush after her son was killed in Iraq. She's in hot water tonight with the IRS for non-payment of taxes, but Sheehan tells us she's already paid enough.
I paid my taxes for, 30 years before my son was killed.
Anti-war activist Cindy Sheehan admits candidly she hasn't paid her federal taxes for a long time.
I feel like it is my moral duty and responsibility to withhold my taxes.
So you haven't paid your taxes since 2004?
Right, and I have not hidden from it.
But Sheehan is now being sued by the feds. This lawsuit, obtained by News 10, seeks to force Sheehan to provide financial records to the IRS after reportedly ignoring a summons.
I feel like I gave my son to this country in an illegal and immoral war. I'll never get him back. And so if they can give me my son back, then I'll pay my taxes. And that's not going to happen.
Sheehan became an anti-war activist after her son, U.S. Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, was killed in Iraq. She attracted national attention after setting up camp in 2005 near President George Bush's ranch in Texas. Most recently, she joined the Occupy movement. Sheehan believes her activist role has made her a target.
Whether they want to make an example of me or are punishing me because I speak out against what my government is doing. With a moral choice, you realize there's consequences, but I'm going to fight it.
Now tonight, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Sacramento denies that Sheehan is being singled out. They call hers a routine tax case. In her blog tonight, Sheehan calls for the IRS to stop the harassment. She says she won't be paying the bill. Cornell Bernard, News Time.
My guess is if the average citizen was told that they had 5 minutes left to live and they were alone in their house, a good percentage of Canadians would devote two or three of those last minutes on Earth to erasing their hard drive. Not because they're criminal, but because it might contain something that's, what's the expression I'm looking for? Nobody's business. And that includes the Minister of Public Safety, Vic Taves. Now, Vic's a nice guy, but he's got this thing. He likes to peek, or at least he wants to peek, into your hard drive. He wants to be able to get your computer's IP address without a warrant. He wants all of your computer online traffic recorded. It's his thing. Now, Vic says it's no big deal. It's like a phone book. Now, I trust Vic, I do. But I asked a computer geek friend of mine, and he says, no. No, it's nothing like a phone book. In fact, it's like a fingerprint, except it's a fingerprint that can tell Vic how much money you make, what you read, where you get your news, what you say to your best friend, what turns you on, and how you vote. Gee, is that all, Vic? Because that makes me uncomfortable. Now, Vic says we have a choice to make here. We can side with the conservatives and let Vic peek, or we can side with the child pornographers. Now, unfortunately for Vic, he forgot one very important thing. Canadians aren't that stupid. And thank God, because Vic, you can call us all the names you want, but that doesn't change the fact we're not going to let you peek. That doesn't make us criminal. It makes us Canadian. It's why we shut our blinds at night. The state has no business in the hard drives of the nation. You want to peek, Vic? Convince a judge, get a warrant.
Okay, very nice. That's Rick Mercer with the Rick Mercer Report. And as I promised, I have Rainbow John West on the phone out of Vancouverland. John, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, welcome back to Unbuttoned Unbossed.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Now, I think last time we talked, I officially made you the Occupy Vancouver movement correspondent for the Unbought and Unbossed show.
Well, that's the second thing I've been appointed to, and I'm not looking for jobs, but I will do them if they come up to be done.
Good, because this one doesn't pay too well. It's just groovy feelings in the heart. That's about what you're going to get paid for, man.
There's a feeling of joy that we're on the right path and we're moving forward. Anyway.
That too.
Get the main information out first. www.rainbowcoalition.ca. Attempts to explain the none-of-the-above option leading to a caretaker government.
Good.
And I'm all speaking for a growing number of people now, and I'm happy to say many of them are proving to be really sound Canadians who've done a great deal of thinking along the same lines. So my experience with the Occupy World in Vancouver, I was there for a month from the day. I didn't stay overnight, but I did discover that in that situation, there was, in my view, a deliberate effort to not allow any sort of cohesion to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, however, grew key groups of people who are not committees, but more commit me people.
Mm-hmm.
On the basis of that, I'm pretty confident that what was started many years ago will come into reality. Now, in terms of the itinerary which is being proposed, and everything, of course, is entirely voluntary, and leadership is, what I'm going to read now is not actually written by me, but I mean, I respect what is written on this pamphlet, and these are available. Occupy World in support of May Day strike. Mm. Opening statement. Can I read this?
Yes, please do.
Okay. We apologize for the correct general impression that there was a total failure of the Occupy Now movement to motivate authority to implement even one demand made by literally millions of people in thousands of communities. And it's because focusing on any one issue was subverted by that authority, who responded with sneaky indifference or violence. And so what actually happened was, right from the start, as soon as anything coherent began to emerge after the demonstration of the practicality of a well-done mic test, I think that does have its value. There's no PA available for people to be heard. But apart from that, and the raising of the issue of consensus, again, as being really vital part of what I personally have been pushing all these years, and that's men and women circles reaching consensus and then coming together to put what they've decided to the common people for authority, and in this way assuming the sovereignty not only of themselves as individuals, making a choice to give up on practicing professional politicians and people who make a living from teaching fraudulent misuse of intelligence like political science and so on. So in other words, we have to move away from the adversarial when it comes to good management of our collective affairs and allow the good ideas to really manifest and not be driven up these silly paths, which now have been resolved and clearly made available to anyone who cares to look into it, that money is a complete fraud from top to bottom. Mm. And if any authority exists in terms of issuance of debt-free money, that resides in a properly established fashion for many years in Canada and was destroyed by Mr. Trudeau in 72, which is about when I blew the whistle on the whole darn thing. Mm-hmm. And that got Canada into a federal debt, which, of course, put people back into tax slavery. Mm-hmm. So, okay, the focus is on one issue, and that really is that the Declaration of 1948, human rights, has never really been, the basic minimums of that cannot be recognized anywhere. Hmm. So it means that a general strike is the only alternative to this growing tyranny. So these are very strong statements, but they are made very seriously, and they're made not by me as a person who's reading this particular out, but I am in total accord with most of what is written here. And this was written by, a part of a deeper movement than the Occupy. The Occupy movement, I think, was a bit of a false flag in many ways. But now it's let loose a torrent of people who are willing and ready to stand for some justice. Anyway, I'm going on a bit, and I'm not giving you a chance to chat or.
No, fine. They can listen to me the rest of the time. I'm happy hearing what you have to say. Now, what were you suggesting? Since you've allowed me, suggesting some persons in the Vancouver Occupy movement attempting to co-opt the direction and the single voice, is that because other cities have complained that they believe that a specific group was there to kind of derail their group, and so
entirely. Okay. No, I think it was in a planned assault, and people who have studied strategy of war and so on say yes, that they opened the hostilities towards the commons in this way by bringing on a sneak attack. By encouraging people to come out and show themselves, right, at a bad time of year in tents and all the rest of it. You know, if that had happened in the spring, it would have been quite a popular uprising, but at that time of year, of course. So they thought that we showed our hands, and actually some of us who'd had our hands waving hard for a long time were quite happy to have the opportunity that it gave us, who'd been largely prevented from speaking publicly, to speak publicly and address things like what does the future hold for us if we take control of our society through our understanding of the challenges that face not only Canada but the world. But if you understand what the force behind that is and apply it, say, to something like the Queen's Jubilee this year, well, a Jubilee, I understand, and I'm not sure you might check this out. I should have not just thought of it right now, but I had thought of it a little bit before, but I haven't researched it. But the concept of a jubilee is forgiveness of debt.
Ah.
Well, if Canada is a symbol to, you know, Her Majesty having done her job for all these years in such a, you know, way that it seems to attract lots of people's attention, at least.
And then let us off the hook,
Whatever, you know. I mean, as a Druid, I tend to look on the mother as being represented in a manner of speaking. That's Mother Earth. So that's a bit deep. But I do see that there is truly a place for, you know, a monarchy, if there's going to be anything. Because kings have a tendency to want to show off. Even consorts do. And I think that's been the problem. That's certainly why I left Britain in 56, because because where I was in terms of analysis of what was going on, because that's the way I'd grown up as a little boy. I mean, there was a war going on, and, you know, I knew all what was going on in the steppes of Russia, you know, or not steppes, but anyway, you know, I mean, I was following all that stuff. So growing up in that atmosphere, I saw the British going down the road to neocolonialism with the Americans and it being a really fascist state emerging. And, you know, I just didn't want to see that happen. Mm-hmm. And as it's been progressively eating its way into the heart of what I see is, you know, the true substance of Canada, which is a kind and loving people, and it's being attacked by these fascists who've got control of the way our media is done and just about everything else.
It's quite frightening what's happening on a federal level in Canada right now. It's absolutely frightening, you know, whether it's this massive crime bill to put, peaceful people behind bars, mandatory sentences, or spying through the Internet. The federal government attempting to steal the election, which if that's what happened, that's actually what happened.
I came to Canada, when I came to Canada and I think in Britain, there still existed some probity, and that meant to say that if there was clear evidence of deceit and lies and malpractice and malfeasance and all the rest of it, then the whistle would be blown. And I've been in a position, I first blew the whistle on the whole thing in 1972, when Mr. Trudeau refused to follow the protocol of going to Parliament, getting the authority from Parliament to take a new path. The Parliament was ready to give him, but the merchant banks decided that, they wanted to squeeze more out of the working people and enslave them more deeply. So instead of Mr. Trudeau being able to come up with an enhanced local initiative program, which was organic in its form, it put up hostels along the way and encouraged people to back to the woods and to be organic in their relationship to Earth. And I mean, it was a very good program, and it was going in the right direction. But Maxwell Henderson, who was then the bagman for Schenley's or Seagram's or one of those big alcohol, monopolies, the corporations, I call them.
Yeah, there you go, nice.
the corporations. Anyway, they're just people that are bent on a path of bigger and bigger numbers in their bank accounts. Well, you know, a well-organized society could allow them to do that. But the thing is, how the power is distributed and what suffering is caused by these loonies, you know, who definitely need their heads seen to. And I put up on my YouTube some time ago that I think, there are certain, let's call it by the name, Mr. Harper, absolutely needs his head read. Surely there are people who could, in that position should be able to have their brains looked at.
To find out if he's...
If he's all there.
Yeah, if he should be holding this office, yeah.
Well, I think the man's lunatic, frankly. Saying that probably run me off to the cop shop, but I think they'd understand what I'm saying because this is ridiculous. Yeah. And we're falling from grace, in my view, at a terrible rate unless we turn ourselves around. Mm. And the opportunity to do that does exist in British Columbia. And we can do that by having universal family credit here, which can call on the Bank of Canada as properly entitled to do to get the money. And if the Liberals take that into their teeth and do it, or the NDP take that into their teeth and do it, which they probably can, then there will be no more poverty in this country. There will be no more taxation in this country. And they say, well, how would you run a country like that? Well, it's called a caretaker government. And it means to say you have a men and women circles meeting separately. And then people say, well, what about the transgestites? Oh, my God, give them a circle, too. And what about the Aboriginal people? Well, I think they should be right in the middle of that twisting helix of the Métis. Have a permanent place there, certainly the grandmothers, with an absolute veto. Mm. If they say no to Enbridge, that's it.
Interesting, yeah. Right.
There's no option. It's not a matter of going to some slummy court. This is what we're dealing with, and we have to be firm because these people have pushed us a long way into a slave fascist state, and people are so indoctrinated that they're only now beginning to wake up, but it's not too late. So we have a general strike. First of all, drumming starts tomorrow. That's the 1st of March, drumming. So we want to get as many people out drumming.
Where's that going to be?
Hey?
What location?
Well, wherever they are. But ideally, okay. If they can get to men circle and women circle and not mix, I think it's better that we begin to learn that men and women are equal and different. And when we acknowledge the difference, then we can come together in a new egalitarianism, which has been lacking. It appeared briefly in the 60s, and then it was destroyed by the punk bands, which were brought up by the CIA to destroy what was becoming very, very, very beautiful in Vancouver by 1966. And by 1972, I was so ticked off and angry that I became the caretaker movement of Canada. And at that point, I said, "Well, I'm not a Canadian, so I'm going to walk right behind the parade, and I'll look after the horse shit, and I'll take care of it."
I understand Vancouver had a pretty flamboyant mayor at the time who was anti-hippie and anti-marijuana. I wasn't around back then, but anyway, so that you were talking about Vancouver back in its heyday.
Well, the thing is, you see, I realize now that pharmaceutical, big pharma, as they like to call it, these activist people, these radicals, you know. the big pharma has always known you can cure just about anything with cannabis.
Yeah, right?
And right now I've given up smoking it, and I'm doing cookies.
There you go.
And I'm feeling more creative and more dedicated to the cause and more, you know, given to the absolute certainty that this time we will triumph, and that common sense will prevail.
And your lungs are probably feeling better as well.
Well, not really. You know,
you don't smoke tobacco.
No, not at all. No. I try and avoid it, except around ladies, friends, and then they all smoke like chimneys, but I don't smoke. But funny thing, when I'm around them, it doesn't bother me. You know, it's like, it's somehow or other just seems to take away what might seem to be evil in it. Anyway, listen, this is very good material. I didn't write this up. You know about Mark Boyer? Mark's a very focused individual.
I don't think I do. I don't think I do. What's his passion?
Well, curiously enough, Mark is a dedicated to hemp person.
Okay.
I've been trying to guide him away from the necessity to go with the marijuana party, but he's been very dedicated in that for a very long time. He's done a lot of jail time. He goes. I go into court with some of these characters occasionally just to observe. And one classic moment with Mark in court was this lady judge sort of screams out to him, "What is it you want, Mr. Boyer?" And he says, "Justice." And she says, "No."
Ah, nice.
And all the sheriffs sort of sat bolt upright. My God. So Drummond starts tomorrow. And then what we're looking for is April Fool's Day. Now, All Fool's Day, anybody who acknowledges that they've been made a fool of for altogether too long should come out and be rendered. Now, if you're rendered as a fool, then you have the authority to say, "Well, look here, I am a fool." And that is considered an honor, because fools don't tell lies. That's one of the problems with fools. They blurt out the truth, you see. That's one of the things they do. and of course, they let secrets. They're no good at secrets either. They actually don't believe in secrets. And so they're no good in conventional intelligence, but they're really valuable to the common people, because they go around telling people what people really need to hear, you see. But is obscured from them.
Interesting.
You know, and that's why I think the cat coming out of the bag.
That's a nice twist. I like the way you turned a fool around. Well done.
Well, you know, it's an honor to be a fool, actually. And if you think about it, the really thoughtful kings had fools, and usually they were lopsided and a bit weird. But in Vancouver, some years ago, the idea was introduced, and there was a court of fools, and I was one of them, because in those days I joined anything that looked like it might be hippie and radical. And, because I was already an older guy then, so I thought, "Oh, God, these guys have a lot of fun." So anyway, I chose to be a part of the court of fools, and I was given a number and so on. But the man who started it was a man called Joachim Voigtjes, and he could be within sound of your radio station. If he is tonight, or if anybody knows, if Joachim Voigtjes, The last I heard of him and met him many years ago was on Luskeedy Island. And I'm not even sure I didn't crash at his place, but he's a wonderful and colorful and incredible man.
Neat.
And if we can get him anywhere, but especially we'd like to get him into Vancouver.
Okay, he's needed, eh?
It would tie us to the past, the 60s and the 70s, you know. It would carry that focus of goodness and honesty and fun and humor. And I was talking to an old gentleman.
You know what, John? I'm going to have to say goodnight really soon.
So
I'm going to give you 30 more seconds to say your final piece, okay?
Okay. My final piece is then the issue in Vancouver then would be the May Day, and we really must get this information that Mr. Boyer is putting out. So I recommend his website is increationwetrust.org.
Okay.
And also it's on my Facebook for people who do that. It's also on, no, I'm still having trouble loading stuff up.
Okay, John, I've got to say goodnight to you, partner.
Yeah, okay, old thing. Thanks, God bless, and happy trails, and this time we shall overcome.
Yeah, I hope so.
God bless.
We'll talk again soon.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, John. Okay, very nice. That's Rainbow John with an update on some Occupy Vancouver stuff. I'm going to finish with a clip by David Icke. This is a fantastic piece. It's on the madness of war. I would like to thank my guests tonight, Andrew Gavin Marshall of Montreal, independent researcher and author, Kevin Annett, who is in New York tonight, and Rainbow John in the Lower Mainland. Okay, friends, this is Unbought and Unbossed saying goodnight for another week. Next week I have Sandra Finley of Saskatoon, a political activist. So that will be the first hour interview. I don't know. I don't think I have anything for the second hour yet, but that's still a week away, right? Okay, friends. Be well out there, friends. And that's her. Cheers.
I don't think I hate anything, but I guess my pet irritation is those that put their head into sand in a gigantic bucket and think if I stay here then everything will be fine and I won't have to face the consequences. But I have to tell them their head's in the sand, their bum's still in the air, and the tornado's coming. And if they want to lift their head, they could avoid it. If they stay there, it's going to hit.
The truth is that so much which is called conspiracy theory is actually conspiracy fact. Not all of it, but enough to show that the people that run the world are not the ones the news media tell us do.
This is the Second World War. If you look at the First World War, after it was over, global power was in dramatically fewer hands than it was when that war started. Nothing changes a society globally or locally like a war. After the Second World War, it was in even fewer hands. And we had the creation of the United Nations. We had the Bretton Woods Agreement. We had the IMF. We had the World Bank came after it. And what they did, these bloodlines, these shadow people at the top of these pyramids, they were behind the British government and the American government of Roosevelt. They were behind Stalin, who was one of their front men. Remember the thing, both sides. And they funded the Nazi party into power, and they funded their war machine. In this book, written, 15-odd years ago, I exposed President Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, as a funder of Hitler and the Rockefellers. The Rockefellers paid for a whole floor of a German university for a guy called Ernst Rudin, who was Hitler's race purity expert, the Rockefellers. And the Rockefellers are behind all these organizations that I'm talking about. Now, Prescott Bush was a leading figure in an organization called the Union Banking Corporation, which was one of the Harriman operations in America. It interfaced with the European steel and banking empire of a guy called Fritz Thyssen, who was an acknowledged funder of Hitler, and funded through to Thyssen vast amounts of money, this is Prescott Bush, the president's grandfather, to fund Hitler. How did they go from the Weimar Republic, when they were taking their wages home in wheelbarrows, such was the inflation, to a war machine that could take on Europe? Because of this. And after I came out with it, a few years passed, and then a guy who's the president of the Holocaust Museum in Florida, he came out publicly in America and said the Bush family fortune overwhelmingly comes from funding the Nazis, and even the Guardian newspaper. Hello, there you are. All right, nice you caught up. In the last year or two has run stories about Prescott Bush funding the Nazis. And what they were doing was creating the two sides to bring into conflict 55 million casualties, by the way, into conflict in a war which has led to the change in the global state. That's how it's done. A Nazi said this. I wonder if we'll kind of recognize this from the last few years. Why, of course, the people don't want war. Why should some poor slob on a farm want to risk his life in a war when the best he can get out of it is to come back to his farm in one piece? Naturally, the common people don't want war, neither in Russia nor in England, nor for that matter in Germany. That is understood. But after all, it is the leaders of the country who determine the policy, and it is always a simple matter to drag the people along, whether it is a democracy or a fascist dictatorship. Voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for their lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. Hermann Göring. Abraham Lincoln said, public sentiment is everything. Without public sentiment, nothing can fail. Without it, nothing can succeed. He who molds opinion is greater than he who enacts the laws. And he could say, he who molds opinion can then enact any laws he wants. Problem, reaction, solution. This is Hitler justifying the creation, that's a later one. This is him from Mein Kampf. All propaganda must be so popular on such an intellectual level that even the most stupid of those towards whom it is directed will understand it. People can be made to perceive paradise as hell and the other way around, to consider the most wretched sort of life a paradise. On the basic intellectual level, it's the terrorists, and we've got to protect you from the terrorists, so we've got to take your freedoms away so we can protect your freedom. Oh, that sounds good, I'll wait for him. Oh, this is another version now. No problem, reaction, solution. You don't need a real problem. You just need the public perception that there's a problem. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. No problem. Public perception there was justifies an invasion on a lie. I love this one. Invasion checklist. Missiles, tanks, troops, planes, bombs, ships, guns. A reason. Come on. Here. I'd say let's have a brainstorm, but apparently that's politically incorrect. You have to have a thought shower now. Let's have a thought shower. True. Bloody true. And because the same people are creating the problem to offer the solution, the same people come up with the problem as well as with the solution. It's kind of strange. This is a picture from 1983 of Donald Rumsfeld meeting Saddam Hussein on behalf of the Reagan Father Bush administration. And what was he doing? Hello, sad, nice to meet you, mate. What he was doing was arranging the shipment of chemical and biological weapons from American corporations to Baghdad to be used against the Iranians in the Iraq-Iranian war. Don't take my word for it. In 2002, State Department documents in America came to light, and this is a mainstream newspaper report of what they said. Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary, and one of the most strident critics of Saddam Hussein, met the Iraqi president in 1983 to ease the way for U.S. companies to sell biological and chemical weapons, including anthrax and bubonic plague cultures, according to newly classified U.S. government documents. When he becomes defense secretary, he's using this. He used chemical weapons against the Kurds. Yes, which you gave him. Problem, reaction, solution. That's how it works. He was on the board of a European engineering giant called ABB in 2000. And at the time he was on the board, ABB sold nuclear technology to North Korea. When he became defense secretary, he condemned North Korea for having nuclear technology. And these stories, I can't go on about it all day, these stories I could list forever, problem, reaction, solution. Like I say, we rejected GM food, now we've got a rising food prices and a food crisis, as they say, and now this government is saying GM food could be a solution. And cuz, like I say, when it's the agenda, they never take no for an answer, and they'll keep bringing it back and keep bringing it back, just like they are with the treaty, which is the Constitution in Europe. Then, alongside problem, reaction, solution, comes the totalitarian tiptoe, as I call it. This works like this. You know you're going there from the start. But you know if you go there in big leaps, the change is going to be so vast that people are going to kind of look up from the television game show and go, hold on, honey, what's going on? Sorry, honey, I thought you were asleep. I was. Lift their head from the game show. And they're going to say, what's going on? So they do it like that. They go from A to B, and then to D, and then maybe to E. They go as quickly as they can and as far as they can with each step, but not so far that they get a big public reaction.